Hello everyone and welcome back to Spin Doctor's Archive, the podcast. I'm Daniel, and in this podcast I present a series of conversations I had last year with Aaron Comas, the drummer of Spin Doctors. Our discussions centered on the band's discography, spanning from their earliest demo recordings to their upcoming seventh album. And this is episode number 2. Today we're talking about the most famous and commercially successful Spin Doctors album, Pocket Full of Kryptonite. And we'll also talk about Homebelly Groove Live, kind of a reworked re-release of the debut EP Up for Grabs. By the way, spindoctorsarchive.com is your source for all things Spin Doctors. Set lists, detailed discographies, news, song infos, and so much more. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Just look for spindoctorsarchive.com. Well, join us for a trip down memory lane to the early 90s and discover how a little-known New York band rose to fame with their hit album Pocket Full of Kryptonite, as told by Aaron himself. Aaron, great to have you here.
Great to be back.
I think every Spin Doctors fan in the world knows the album we are talking about today. It's Pocket Full of Kryptonite. Today it's considered a classic and everyone knows it. It's your bestseller. It's an album that sold millions and millions of copies and it still sounds very fresh and very, very good. Let's talk about it from the perspective back in the day when you made it. And of course, I'm interested in hearing what you think about it all those years later.
Okay, well, you know, we were definitely really focused and excited to make that record. You know, it's going to be, we had done the EP thing and we were really excited to put out a great record. I remember at the time we were all really interested. We were listening a lot to Living Color was big and we loved their first record, and Jane's Addiction, Been Caught Stealing record was something we play a lot. And, we just wanted to make a record that really sort of showcased the four of us. I remember we used to, even though we don't sound like them, we used to use Van Halen as a reference because the way you listen to
Van Halen.
Okay. Because Van Halen 1 was like four guys. Everything was sort of louder than the next thing. It was just, and we actually use that as a reference a lot. Like we want to make a record that's kind of sounds like Van Halen. And so, like I mentioned to you in the last thing, we did two sessions. So the first session for Pocket Full of Kryptonite was originally supposed to be an EP. And then we decided to do the live EP Up for Grabs. So the songs that made Pocket Full of Kryptonite from that session were Two Princes and Shinbone Alley, Hard to Exist.
Yeah.
We also recorded How Could You Want Them? And I think we might have done Hungry Homids. And maybe something else, but we only used the three versions that I just mentioned.
See,
that record was produced. That session was produced by Frank Aversa, and it was recorded at the Power Station, which is the best sounding room in the world. I mean, the drum sounds in that room are phenomenal. And
there anymore, right? Or is it?
No, it is. It closed, but Berkeley bought it, and it's back in business, which is great. It was called Avatar for years.
Yeah.
Now it's called the Power Station again at Berkeley. And they left everything the same. So anyway, but that room is just incredible.
It's quite an honor for a young band to record there.
Yeah. Right. There was a lot of history in there. So you walk into this place, and all these incredible records that have been done there. So it was a big deal. You know, we're walking into the Power Station and, for a drummer, particularly, I've done a lot of records there over the years, but nothing like that first time going in there. I had my Brady kit, everything set up, and it just sounded incredible, sonically, there's something really special about that record, and particularly Two Princes and the Segway, which were recorded in that room. But, Two Princes, those three songs, I think more than the rest of the record, we did some pre-production with Frank Aversa. We had a room for a couple of days. We really sort of worked out those arrangements. And that's where we slowed down Two Princes. I think Two Princes really took a turn. And I personally believe that I don't think it would have ended up being the big major hit it was if we did it.
So you had that old version in mind, which ended up on the piece of glass demo, and you were like, we need to change.
I never liked the tempo. I never liked it. I always thought the song was too fast. I knew it was a great song, but I'll give myself credit. I was actually the one that suggested, let's slow this song down. It feels like, you know, it's a great song, but right now it's just sort of like a bouncy, it feels more like a bouncy rock tune. And I felt like this thing could be like a, you know, a almost like a hip hop groove. I mean, just more of a dance kind of thing with this pop thing and rock thing. And so we slowed down the tempo. We found a really nice tempo. And then we did some things in pre-production. You know, I got to give Frank Aversa credit. He really like sort of, there's some like stops and starts, a little subtle things that we weren't doing. If you listen to the version on Piece of Glass. And so we had a really nice arrangement of it, you know, and then we just recorded it. And really it's like, I mean, I'm a believer that like, you know, to have a hit song, it's difficult. There's so many deserving songs out there that should have been huge hits. Yeah. The stars have really got to align for that to happen. There's a lot of things.
Were you aware that you were sitting on gold in a way with those songs?
No,
or did you expect them to get big?
Not really. I knew that, like, you know, I think, anyway, not really. I think we all knew that a couple of those songs were going to, we used to call them our white bread hits. We had jokes like with our manager, you know, like Two Princes and Little Miss and Jimmy Olsen and Big Fat Funky Booty and What Time Is It? We always called them our white bread hits.
Yeah.
And then we had like Shimbo and Ali and 40 or 50 and the more jammy rockin' tunes.
More complicated in a way, complex songs. Huh?
Yeah. So, but with Two Princes, I mean, I think it was like, it all started like, you know, when we recorded it that day, everything just hit. We just played, you know, great. We got a really good version of the song. I don't think we did too many takes. We tended to be a band that like, you know, didn't do like 100 takes. Often on most of our records, often these songs are first, second, or third takes. It's very rare that we'll labor over something too long. And Two Princes just worked, you know, and like, I think everybody played great. It's also very simple, you know, it's drums, big fat drum sound, you know. Mark's bass playing he's got a great bass line. He's playing with his fingers. Mm-hmm. It's not thumb. So there's a real openness to it. So there's a lot of space in there. Eric, you know, rented this incredible Les Paul guitar from Artie Smith. Artie Smith was the guy that would be at all the big sessions. He'd tech drums, he'd tech guitars. He always had a huge list of gear you could rent from him. So that was a really expensive rental, that guitar, but it was worth it. And the sound of Eric's guitar is just so cool. It's big and distorted, and he's playing this great part. And so the music, the me and Eric and Mark, is just a very simple sort of groove, and there's not a lot of overdubs. So I think it really just popped on the tape. And Chris's vocal, you know, incredible vocal, incredible song, great lyrics. He did a beautiful vocal. And again, there's really no background vocals until the end of the song. And then, you know, that's John Popper doing the low harmony, and Chris is doing a high harmony. And there's a tambourine, and that's it. So it's a very simple recording, but sonically, it's incredible. And I think that really helped a lot, too, because when it finally got on the radio, it really stood out. There was something like unique about it. Like, wow. And I remember at the time, people would always say like, you know, man, you know, I mean, obviously I got a lot of props on my drum sound, you know, to this day, people are like, you know, it's like the best snare drum sound I've ever heard. And I've been chasing it myself for 30 years. You know, I mean, it's just like, it's again, it's like when everything just sort of comes together, you know? So that was, not to talk too much about that, but that was sort of the story of those three songs. And then we got sidetracked and we were touring. We ended up doing those Up for Grabs thing at Wetlands. Yeah. Then we came back to do now we got to finish Pocket Full of Kryptonite. We have to decide what we're going to use from that session and what we're going to record now. And we loved Peter Denenberg from working with him on Up for Grabs. So we decided, let's just go in the studio with Peter and Frankie. So Peter and Frankie and us produced the rest of that record. And we went to RPM Studios. RPM is a great studio. We recorded Piece of Glass there.
Piece of Glass already there, yeah.
Eric had worked as an intern there years before. It was right in the East Village. It was like, it was just a great vibe, you know. It didn't have quite the same sonic qualities that the Power Station had, but it was a nice room, had great gear, and we made it sound great. Mm-hmm. And we recorded the rest of the record, which, you know, there, I remember they were great sessions. We had a really good time. Those sessions were a bit more, I don't even think we did pre-production for those. Those were more like, we just went in there, you know, all those songs we had already played, like, I mean, hundreds of times. Yes. You know, we'd probably already done, what, 300 or 400 gigs at that point?
Yeah.
More.
So they were really road tested already, and you know what you had to do.
We were a well-oiled machine. So we knew what we had to do. But I will say that we made a lot of the coolest moments from that record were changes that we made right there on the floor. Like okay. For instance, Refrigerator Car. Again, listen to the version on Piece of Glass, right?
Yeah.
There's no drum intro, right? That's just true. Come right in. So that happened right there. And I was just messing around before a take. I had the idea to like play that rhythm of that. Of that da na na da ga da ga da ga da, that guitar
that
riff.
That weird measure, yeah.
Exactly. The one in 9/8. And I started messing around thinking, oh, this is kind of cool. And then Eric was standing there, he's like, that's awesome, man. And then he started playing it, and we were like, let's make that an intro. And that's all it was. And then we just did it. And then boom, we had this killer fucking intro to Refrigerator Car. That happened.
When you think of that song, you think of that intro by now, right?
Yeah, and you know, that happened literally 5 minutes before we cut the song. You know,
it was fantastic.
And then, you know, Jimmy Olsen Blues, I believe we changed keys on the guitar solo. That happened right there in the control room. I think we were listening back to a version, and Eric was like, "Let's modulate to this chord the solo, and then we'll come back." So that was again something else that happened right there. You know, Little Miss. Up to that point, Little Miss didn't have that sort of Chuck Berry hook that Eric played.
Yeah.
He was just doing the chunka chugga thing for all along. Every time we played that song live, it was just a da na 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 na. Never had the and that didn't we recorded the track and we were working on it, and Chris was doing vocals, we were listening to it and digging it. And then later when we were doing overdubs, Eric came up with that Chuck Berry riff. So that was another thing that just happened there that really lifted that song a lot. I'm trying to think of other little things. Those are some, you know, big arrangement things that happened like right then and there.
The guest appearances by John Popper, were they on purpose or were they by accident?
Yeah. No, we knew we wanted to have John. You know, John's always hanging around anyway. He'd be coming in. I don't know if we like thought about it, if he was just there. We're like, hey man, why don't you play a harmonica solo on this? But whatever it was, he played a harmonica solo on More Than She Knows. And I remember we were joking with him, like, you know, could you play a few more notes, buddy? And I mean, it was just classic Popper. And I think he probably just did one take and it was just like, oh, okay, that's go home.
And he's on Off My Line as well.
Off My Line too. That's right. We had him do Off My Line. And so that was great. We knew we had to have Popper on the record. I mean, he's Popper. We're so close with the Blues Traveler and John. John was always, to this day, is like an honorary Spin Doctors member. You know, he played our first gig with us. It was great to have him on the record, you know.
So you have like these 11 songs, 10 tracks, and you're finished with that. You have talked about the sequencing of the album and so on. And did you get the feeling, wow, this is perfect? Or did you think there was room for improvement? How did it feel back in the day? I mean, by now we're looking at the classic, and I'm always wondering, did you feel the same way back in the day?
Yeah, well, I want to mention one other thing, because we did have another guest, John, my good friend John Bush, also guested on that record.
He's playing congas, right?
Yeah, he's a great drummer, percussionist. Yeah. I grew up with him in Dallas. He plays in Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians. And I think he was just in town, like they might have been doing something. And we were like just hanging out that week. And, you know, it was just one of those things, like, you know, he was hanging with us. I think we were doing some mixing or maybe some final overdubs. The record was pretty much done. We were up at Peter's place in Mamaroneck, and John came up and he played congas on How Could You Want Them? And then he played some killer tambourine on Off My Line. So I think him and John were the only additional musicians on the record, right? Yeah. So anyway, going back to your question. Yeah, I mean, I think we, once we finally like finished everything, And we decided what songs we were going to use. You know, we decided, okay, we're going to take Two Princes and Shimbo and Hard to Exist from that Avatar session. And then we're going to take these songs from RPM. Because there was a lot of others. There were definitely some songs that we recorded that didn't make it, you know.
So you had a lot to choose from.
Yeah, we had a lot to choose from. But it was pretty obvious. I mean, the cream rises to the top. You know, we had so much material. And we had to pick 11 songs, right? And we didn't want to put like 20 songs on the record. I mean, this is the very beginning of CDs. So all of a sudden you could make records longer. But
yeah.
I think we all agreed we want to stick to the original LP format. We wanted to feel, and they were still making cassettes and vinyl too. So you still sort of thought in terms of A side and B side. Mm-hmm. And we were very aware of that, you know, A side and B side, except the CD came out then. And so you just heard it back down from top to bottom.
Yeah.
But so we picked those songs. We felt like we wanted to really represent, you know, what we used to call the white bread hits, but also really represent the really rocking side of the band. I love the record. I think we all felt really good about it at the time. And I remember at the time I had some problems with it. You know, I was 21 or something. you hear every little nuance of something you felt like you could have done better, or maybe certain things in a mix might have bothered me. And it's funny because all those things that bothered me then, I love now.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I don't really, here's an example. Like when we were mixing the record, I wanted to have a pretty dry drum sound. Because we were coming out of the 80s where everything was just massive, you know, yeah. Big fucking Guns N' Roses and Bon Jovi, huge
stadium metal bands. And
yeah. And so that was, you know, and Frankie LaRocca, who was co-producing, you know, he came from that scene and he really always wanted really big drum sounds. So, and Peter was mixing and Peter had his ideas. But I remember between me and Frankie, Frankie would always be going over to the board and turning up the room and making the drums sound big. And then I'd sneak over there and I'd turn them down. And finally, Peter was like, you guys got to fucking stop this shit, you know? So, but what ended up happening is we really found a good balance between these two ideas and ended up with what I think is just a tremendous drum sound. I mean, it's phenomenal throughout the whole record. And there is a lot of air and room in it, but it's not so over the top that it's like 80s. But it's also not, had we sort of done it the way I wanted at the time, it would have been real sort of close and dry. And I don't think it would have nearly had the energy that it ended up with. So, you know, some of those things that bothered me a little bit then, I mean, I'm so grateful for now, you know.
Let's take a quick break from the interview for a music recommendation.
They call me Chris Barron. Chris Barron is my name.
SpinDoctorsArchive.com proudly presents the best of the Chris Barron Thirsty Thursday Happy Hour.
It's the Chris Barron Thirsty Thursday Happy Hour.
This musical compilation features live recordings from Chris's weekly webcast series, which he presented during the peak of the pandemic in 2020 and 2021, compiled and edited by yours truly.
Down my jeans, say daddy, dad, I wanna go to Hollywood and be in the picture shows, and he said, no, I'm up.
I simply picked my favorite performances from the 2021 run of the show and created a live sampler for everyone to enjoy.
These things and others I find all in the eye of the needle.
It gets even better. Chris Barron himself gave the green light for the project and even crafted a touching and moving introduction for the collection, which is really worth reading.
Don't look down as you soar for miles, 'cause every fool who falls gets to fly for a while.
Visit our website spindoctorsarchive.com to stream or download the free compilation album The Best of the Chris Barron Thirsty Thursday Happy Hour. I really, really recommend it.
Daniel loves the deep cuts.
And back to Aaron and the exciting time of Kryptonite and Homebelly Groove Live. But by the way, do you enjoy listening to your own recordings? Do you do it on occasion, or is it like, if it's done, I'm done with it?
I never listen. I mean, when you're making a record,
Yeah.
When we're in the middle of making a record,
of course, you listen to it a thousand times. Yeah.
Yeah. But then I don't. And then after you finish it, you listen to it a lot. And then I don't ever want to listen to it again. But I hear, you know, like I haven't listened to Pocket Full of Kryptonite in years. I mean, every now and then I might hear it, or, you know, I hear Two Princes a lot because I'll be walking in a clothing store.
Obviously.
And you know, Little Miss. But the thing I will say is, like, I'm so happy because whenever Two Princes comes on, it just sounds fucking great. It really sounds good. And every time I hear it, I'm just like, I'm just sort of thankful. Like, I'm so glad that this song that gets so much play sounds so good.
Yeah.
It just sounds great. You know, it's just one of those things that just really, like I was saying before, just the stars aligned, it came together and it sounds phenomenal. And I think that record really holds up because, again, we wanted to make an organic record. We didn't want to make a record that sounded too much like any era. We wanted, like most really good music, you want it to be timeless. And I think a lot of, like, the production in the 80s, although I love that stuff, you know, I think I didn't like it at the time, but I liked a lot of the stuff in the 80s is got a lot, it's very fun and it's colorful, but you can hear it, you can really hear it's the 80s, you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
certain eras. And I think with us, I mean, you know, it's the 90s because it brings back memories. People hear those songs, they think about that time period. But I think the music and the recordings, I think, hold up very well because it's really pretty organic, you know.
Yeah, but that sound of yours was part of why I fell in love with the band back in the day, because it did not sound like the 80s or like like those big stadium metal bands. It sounded different, and it did not sound like the grunge stuff, which was big at the time as well. So maybe as you said, the stars aligned and you had a really good album, but it took quite a while to get the attention it deserved.
Yeah, we definitely believed in it, and I think you know, we put out the record. We were very excited. I don't think we had any, like, massive expectations that it was going to be this huge hit.
Yeah.
But we really liked it. But I think as time went on and we started touring and things were really starting to develop very organically for us, you know, at this point, we had spent all our tour support money. So we were either going to come home and do nothing, or we're going to go back out, and we got rid of the bus and got back on our two vans and toured the country for over and over. And we were a self-sufficient band. We were paying our bills. We're starting to pack clubs around the country. The record was selling. I mean, you know, it wasn't doing great, but I think by the end of that year, we had sold about 50,000 records.
Mm-hmm. Which was pretty impressive for a young band, right?
I mean, at the time, it was enough for a record company to say, okay, this is dead, you need to come home. But but for us, it was like, well, considering you guys have done absolutely nothing for us, it's pretty good. What if you guys did a little something? Maybe it would really do good. So we were back in New York. This was about a year or so in, and we had a big meeting up at Sony. All the heads of the company, our management, all the guys in the band. And Sony said, okay, this record's dead. There's no hits. Time for you guys to come back home and make a new record. And we were like, well, you know, we're out here on the road and we're doing really well. We see a great reaction. People are, like, singing along with our songs, you know, particularly songs like Jimmy Olsen Blues and Two Princes and Little Miss Can't Be Wrong. What Time Is It? These songs really seem to be striking a chord. Like, why don't you guys, what if you guys, like, maybe tried to, like, put one out, you know? And they were just like, no, these are not hits. And you guys don't have an image. You guys just wear the same clothes on stage you do every day. It's just, you know, you need to make a new record. So we're like, whatever. So we left, and we huddled outside of Sony, the band and our manager, Jason. And to David's credit, he said, fuck this. I've seen this before. You guys have got a great buzz. I really think we just need to go back on the road. Something is going to happen. I've seen it before. He managed Meatloaf. He was the guy that did Bat Out of Hell. And he said, I saw the same thing with Meatloaf. The record was dead. Nobody was paying attention to it. But we were doing great. And we just stayed touring. And after about a year and a half, radio started to pick it up. And look what happened. It became one of the biggest selling records of all time. So we decided, okay, let's do it. We booked a tour, got back in our van, went on the road. And sure enough, a couple months later, WEQX in Vermont added Little Miss Can't Be Wrong. And it went to number one. And the guy, Jim McGuinn, wrote a letter to Richard Griffiths, the head of Epic, stating you guys would be fools not to release this band, as you know, put some money behind this band. This record should be gold at least, you know. And so that was what lit the fire, and they ended up releasing Little Miss to rock radio. It very quickly became a hit. Then they did a video that got all over MTV, and then everything blew up, you know. So again, and you know, I've told this story a lot, but it's a good story because had we not believed in the record and had we not stuck to our guns, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I probably would never have met you, and we wouldn't be talking. We wouldn't have been talking about this right now. So it's great.
Fantastic story. Great it went the way it went. So how does Homebelly Groove fit into the whole scheme of things? It was like released in 1992, and you were still touring with the Pocket for Kryptonite album, but it wasn't big yet, right?
Kryptonite was just it was starting to take off, you know. So what Homebelly Groove was is it's really one thing and one thing only. It's Epic Records trying to make more money.
I see.
They want, because they were like, okay, we're happening now. Kryptonite's selling. Let's re-release Up for Grabs, but add some more songs to it and change the title. You know what I mean? So that's all it was. And then we were all for it. I mean, because it was like, great, we're going to put out some more. We're going to give Up for Grabs now a chance to get heard. And we're going to add some more songs. We had a whole concert from that Wetlands show. And we're going to release it. So we were all for it. It wasn't like any kind of, we don't want to do that. But it was them basically, you know, just trying to figure out how to re-release Up for Grabs and make some money, which was great. And so we added those songs and re-released Homebelly. And it did pretty well. I don't know if it ever went gold. I think it came pretty close. I don't know the actual numbers, but I think it went.
It did pretty good. For me, it was like my first introduction in your live sound, as I came as a fan with Two Princes, as millions of other fans did. And to me, this was the original live album, actually. So I did not know about For Grabs back in the day. I was only wondering, as a European, why are there three songs that were bonus tracks of Pocket for a Kryptonite in the European version of it? But I really love Homebelly Groove, knowing the history about the record, that it's kind of a mixed thing with like some tracks from 1990, some tracks from 1992, but this release works for me. So I think it's a great representation of how you sound live.
Remind me though, did Homebelly Groove have, it was more songs from the Wetlands, but then did it
Homebelly Groove has four tracks off of Up for Grabs. It's Freeway, Lady Kerosene, Little Miss, Your Mamas and Rosetta Stone. And the other stuff is from a 1992 show you did for WNEW.
For Roadhouse.
What Time Is It Off My Line, Yo Baby, Shinbone Alley, Refrigerator Car, Sweet Widow, Stepped on a Crack. Yeah, that's
okay, that. But Stepped on a Crack and What Time Is It Off My Line are from Wetlands.
So more cuts from the original recording from 1990.
Right.
I see.
Those are from the Wetlands. And the Shinbone Alley, whatever the other ones are from, we did a show
at I think Shinbone Alley and Refrigerator Car, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's right.
And Little Miss Can't Be Wrong is also from the 1992 show, and it's not the same as on Up for Grabs. So this was my mistake. I'm sorry.
Right, okay. So was Little Miss on Up for Grabs? I don't think it was, right?
Yes, it was. Track 5 on Up for Grabs. But Little Miss from Homebelly Groove is a different one. But I'm not 100% sure at the moment.
Yeah, I think you're right. Because I remember that Roadhouse thing. I got to hear that Little Miss on Up for Grabs, because now I'm wondering if Eric played the Chuck Berry riff then, because I think that was before. Unless we recorded Kryptonite, it's also possible that we finished Kryptonite before that Up for that Wetlands gig. And
that's possible.
It is possible.
As we were talking earlier, things happened very quickly and very fast.
They did. Yeah. And we were just so busy. We were touring. We were playing gigs. We were in the studio. Because now that you mention it, Pocket Full of Kryptonite had been done for about a year before it actually came out. So that's wrong, because Peter Denenberg, I met Peter Denenberg for the first time at the Wetlands for Up for Grabs. So, all right. Anyway.
Yeah, we're talking about things that are like 30 years ago. So it's absolutely okay if you like mix up some dates or something like that. Okay, let's wrap it together for this chapter by telling me what are your favorite cuts of Pocket for Kryptonite.
Oh man. Well, I gotta say Two Princes, because you know, not only was it such a huge hit and has really kept us going for so long, I just think it's great. I mean, I think it's I don't know that we've ever recorded anything better. I mean, I just love it. I think it's an incredible song. I think the version is great. The sound of it's great. It's kind of like the perfect track. I mean, I'm just happy that it's done so well. Like
that
I said
song,
before,
that song impacted your life in a certain way.
Yeah, and I really like it. I'm always really pleased when I hear it, which is because we were so young. I mean, I think I was like 21 when I recorded that. You know, yeah. So it's like I'm just happy I had my shit together that day. It really, really sounds great. So yeah, I gotta say Two Princes. You know, and then
told me that you really like Shinbone Alley as a representation of what the band is able to achieve. How do you feel about the tracked version?
I think that also that may be my second favorite on the record. I think it's great. I think it's it's a great representation of the band. You know, everybody just shines on it. It's a classic Spin Doctors song. You know, it's one of the quintessential Spin Doctors songs, I think. And it's a really good version.
Great. So thank you very much for talking about Pocketful of Riptonite and Home Belly Groove.
My pleasure.
That was our interview number 2. And I checked again, Aaron was right. The version of Little Miss on Up for Grabs doesn't yet have the Chuck Berry riff. And that's probably one of the reasons why a different version was used for Home Belly Groove, the one from 1992. I'm Daniel Heinze. Thanks for listening. If you like the podcast, please give it a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify and make sure to subscribe so you don't miss another episode. And for more information about Spin Doctors, visit me at spindoctorsarchive.com. The next episode will be about one of my absolute favorites, Turn It Upside Down from 1994. Until then, mau bi jiao, people.